Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on cross-examination when we come back. You know, we Americans may hold the dubious honor of being the most litigious people in the world, but when it comes to law, we seem to be among the most ignorant. Today, most Americans feel powerless to resist these evils that they see perpetrated against our liberties, our privacy, and our property by these powerful government agencies and multinational corporations, lobbies, and the news media. But you know, we don't have to remain helpless. The institution designed by God and incorporated into our Constitution and Bill of Rights is called the judicial power. Now, the courts are the proper repository for the protection of our rights, our liberties, and our property, not the Congress, not the political process. Now, did you know that the privilege against self-incrimination is neither accorded to the passive resistant nor to the person who is ignorant of his rights? Not to someone who's indifferent thereto. And that's because it is a fighting clause, and its benefits can be retained only by sustained combat. And it cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. It is valid only when insisted upon by you, the belligerent claimant in person. So says U.S. versus Johnson. And that's why I contend that we should listen more to the judges and listen a whole lot less to the politicians and the lawyers. Now, did you hear what that judge said in that statement? He said, your rights cannot be claimed by your attorney or solicitor. Your rights can only be claimed by you, the belligerent claimant in person. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967 and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. That number to call again, 417-273-4967. Remember, courtroom strategy and procedure, the school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, click on to the email machine, and then send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about cross-examination. I told you that there were 23 techniques that we use in cross-examination to impeach the testimony, to show that the witness is a liar. It's a two-edged sword. Sometimes the witness will show that the cross-examiner is inept, or that he's ignorant, or in some cases, just plain stupid. So if you're a witness, and then you're being cross-examined, if you could show that the cross-examiner is ignorant or just plain stupid, by all means do so. It's like the Roman gladiators fighting the Christians or fighting the lions. There's a contest going on, and in this contest, the jury is the audience, and you're trying to impress the jury or the judge, the audience in this case. So, if you want to be a good witness, you need to be trained as a witness. If you want to be a good cross-examiner, you need to be trained as a cross-examiner. And a place to start is with cross-examination, the art of cross-examination by Francis Wellman. Remember, you can get that book in paperback from Barnes & Noble. It's called The Art of Cross-Examination, first copyrighted back in 1902. It's the standard in the legal industry. Every lawyer is trained out of Francis Wellman on cross-examination. And you ought to be trained out of it too, because it's not only the best source of cross-examination techniques, It puts everybody on a level playing field. Now, we all know the same story. So last time I showed you that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. Now, if you don't know that and you give statements to the police, and 25% of the statements that you give to the police are false, and then they check out your statements, they give that to the prosecuting attorney, and he makes you look stupid on the witness stand having contradicted yourself a number of times. But contradiction isn't the only methodology by which we impeach the testimony of a witness. Now, here's a cute one. Listen to this. Another amusing incident leading to the exposure of a manifest fraud occurred in another of the many damage suits brought against the Metropolitan Street Railway, and it grew out of a collision between two of the company's electric cars. Now, the plaintiff, a laboring man, had been thrown to the street pavement from the platform of the car by the force of the collision. He had dislocated his shoulder. He had testified in his own behalf that he had been permanently injured insofar as he had not been able to follow his usual employment for the reason that he could not raise his arm above a point parallel with his shoulder. Now, upon cross-examination, while acting for the railroad, I asked the witness a few sympathetic questions about his sufferings, and after I got on a friendly basis with him, I suggested that he be good enough to show the jury the extreme limit to which he could raise his arm since the accident. So the plaintiff, slowly and with considerable difficulty, raised his arm to the parallel of his shoulder. Now, using the same arm, please show the jury how high you could get it up before the accident, was the next quiet suggestion, whereupon the witness extended his arm to its full height above his head amid peals of laughter from the court and the jury. This is called the power of suggestion. The power of suggestion. Now, obviously, this witness was lying. He said he was permanently disabled, couldn't follow his usual line of work. There wasn't any doubt that he'd been injured. But he wasn't permanently disabled. Now, here in our county, the highest social status that you can achieve in Ozark County, Missouri, is total disability. I mean, when you're on total disability, you're looked up to as one of the peers in society. You have arrived. You have it all together. Now, I wouldn't go so far as to say that everybody in Ozark County is lazy, but there is a good number of people that are lazy and they don't want to work and they want to live off of Social Security. Now, back at the turn of the century and before the turn of the century, Americans did not live off of disability. And they looked down upon people who tried to live in such a way that they didn't work. And here was a guy who wanted to take advantage of the railway system. He had been injured, no doubt about that. But instead of saying, okay, I was injured, now pay me for my injury and I'll go about my business and go back to work, he wanted to draw total disability for the rest of his life. That's a theft. It's a manifest fraud. And it was uncovered by the power of suggestion. You know, oftentimes you just suggest to somebody and he'll take the bait. And that's what happened here. One of 23 techniques that we use to show these kinds of manifest frauds, to show that this guy is a liar. Let's take a look at another one. Daniel Webster considered Mason the greatest lawyer that ever practiced at the New England Bar. And he said of Mason, I would rather, after my own experience, meet all the lawyers that I've ever known combined in a case than meet him alone and single-handed. Mason was always reputed to have possessed to a marked degree the instinct for the weak point in the witness that he was cross-examining. Well, in a recent celebrated criminal case known as the Triangle Fire case, two proprietors of a ladies' shirtwaist factory were indicted on a charge of manslaughter. 175 girls had lost their lives because of a door in the loft of the factory was kept locked during working hours. It was in violation of the factory law, and it was charged against the owners of the factory. Max D. Stewart, while conducting the defense, developed a most striking illustration of the value, when the proper occasion arises, of compelling a witness to repeat on cross-examination every detail of the story given on direct examination. This is especially so where the story has been extremely helpful to the site for which it was given and even calculated to create something of a sensation. But where a constant repetition of the story is apt to disclose evidences of a carefully prepared recital, rather than a spontaneous recollection of actual occurrences. Now, it was an essential part of the people's case to prove that the girl, Rose Schwartz, mentioned in the indictment, was in fact the same person who lost her life in the fire. 100 witnesses had been sworn on behalf of the people. Many weeks had been consumed in hearing the testimony, and not a word had been said about Rose Schwartz, named in the indictment, excepting that her name had been casually mentioned as on the list of employees. The testimony, on the contrary, had at all times been to the effect that the bodies had been discovered in the building and that they were so charred that identification was impossible. At the very close of the people's case, the court door was suddenly opened and one of the court attendants appeared with a very good-looking young woman who immediately attracted the attention of the jury on her way to the witness stand. The district attorney became very solemn. A hushed air of expectancy was created in the courtroom. The judge himself proceeded to swear in the witness, although all the other witnesses had been sworn in the ordinary way by the clerk of the court. Now, having testified to many preliminary details, such as what the witness had been employed at the factory and was there when the fire broke out and that she knew Rose Schwartz, she was asked this question. Quote, "Now, will you tell everything that you saw and did on the ninth floor of those premises from the time that the fire broke out?" So the witness then began to describe her first sight of the flames, how the girls scattered from one floor and ran to another, how many of them ran to the windows and began to jump out, how she herself had decided to follow their example. When she was at the window about ready to jump, she glanced around the room in a desperate effort to escape, and looking at the Washington Street door that was supposed to have been locked, she saw Rose Schwartz with both hands on the knob of the door, desperately turning the knob in an attempt to open the door, both by pulling and pushing, but the door would not give. She stayed there transfixed, watching Rose, and she saw the flames envelop her hands, saw her fall to the floor, and then saw her once more struggle to her feet, again grab the knob of the door and turn it one way and then the other, pull and then push, but the door would not give. Once more the flames enveloped Rose, and again she had to withdraw her hands from the doorknob, and she fell to the floor. The flames were now coming very close to the witness. She turned once more toward the Washington Street door, and there for the third time she saw Rose Schwartz on her knees, screaming and praying, with both hands on the doorknob, turning it first one way and then the other, and pulling and pushing, but the door would not give. And finally, she was completely enveloped by the flames and fell to the floor within a foot of the Washington Street door. There was not a single dry eye in the jury box when she closed her testimony. Now, the first half hour of the cross-examination was confined to preliminaries, during which the witness told how she was rescued, first taken to a hospital and then taken home, how she had been brought to the district attorney's office and had had many interviews with the various assistant district attorneys, and how finally she had been moved to Philadelphia at the discretion of the district attorney so that she should be beyond the approach of the defendants and was housed there at the expense of the government, and how she was visited there a number of times by representatives of the district attorney's office. And at the end of the half hour, she was asked, "Now, you remember just where you were seated at the time when you first saw the first sign of a fire?" And she answered yes. And then, in the exact words in which the district attorney had put his question, the question was repeated to her, asking her to state all that she did herself and all that she saw done on the ninth floor from that moment on. So she began her narrative with exactly the same word that she had used when she told her story the first time on direct examination, and continued in precisely the same words that she had used to the district attorney in answering that question. Thereupon, the subject was once again changed, and nearly a half hour was used in examination upon various matters relating to the fire. At the end of this second half hour, the question was for the third time put, and the witness started with the exact same word and continued to narrate the story in precisely the same words that she had used before, except that she omitted one word. She was asked whether or not the fact that she had omitted a word, naming the word, and her lips began to move and start the narrative to herself all over again. And when she reached the position where that word belonged, she said, "Yes, I made a mistake. I left out that word." "But otherwise, your answer was correct." And she began again to move her lips, obviously reciting to herself what she had previously said. And then she said, "Yes, otherwise my answer is correct." When the question was put to her for the third time, the district attorney vigorously objected, but he was overruled. Another period of 20 minutes or more was used in examining her with relation to other matters, and then for the fourth time the question was put to her again. "Will you please tell the jury what you saw and what you did after you first observed any sign of the flames?" She started with the same word, and she continued her narrative, but again left out one word. This time it was a different word. When asked whether she had not now omitted a word, naming it, she went through the same lip performance and replied that she had, and upon being asked to place the word where it belonged, she proceeded to do so. There was no further examination of that witness, and there were no more tears in the jury box. Now the situation had entirely changed. The witness had not hurt, but had very materially helped the defense. She had succeeded in casting grave suspicion on the testimony of many of the girls who had previously testified, and her carefully prepared story had aroused the suspicions of the jury regarding the entire case of the prosecution. If perjured testimony in our courts were confined to the ignorant classes, the work of cross-examining them would be a comparatively simple matter. But, unfortunately, for the cause of truth and for the cause of justice, this is far from the case. Perjury is decidedly on the increase, and at the present time in our local courts, scarcely a trial is conducted in which it does not appear in a more or less flagrant form. Nothing in the trial of a cause is so difficult as to expose the perjury of a witness whose intelligence assists him to hide his lack of scruple, and there are various methods of attempting it, but no uniform rule can be laid down as to the proper manner to be employed toward such a witness. It all depends upon the individual character that you have to unmask. Now, in a large majority of cases, the chance of success will be greatly increased by not allowing the witness to see that you suspect him as being a liar. Before you have led the witness to commit himself as to various matters with which you have reason to believe that you can confront him later on and show inconsistencies or lies, there are two famous cross-examiners at the Irish bar. They were Sergeant Sullivan, afterwards Master of the Rolls in Ireland, and Sergeant Armstrong. Barry O'Brien, in his Life of Lord Russell, describes their methods. Sullivan, he says, approached the witness in a very friendly way, seemed to be an impartial inquirer, seeking information, looked surprised at what the witness said, appeared even grateful for the additional light thrown on the case. Ah, indeed. Well, as you have said so much, perhaps you can help us a little further. Well, really, my lord, this is a very intelligent man. So playing the witness with caution and skill, drawing him stealthily on, keeping him completely in the dark about the real point of attack, the little sergeant waited until the man was in the meshes, and then flew at him and shook him like a terrier would shake a rat. The big Sergeant Armstrong had more humor and more power, but less dexterity and resource. His great weapon was ridicule. He laughed at the witness and made everybody else laugh. The witness got confused and lost his temper, and then Armstrong pounded him like a champion in the ring. Now, in some cases, it is wise to confine yourself to just one or two very salient points on which you feel confident that you can get the witness to contradict himself out of his own mouth. It is seldom useful to press him on matters with which he is familiar. It is the safer course of action to question him on circumstances connected with his story, but to which he has not already testified, and for which he would not be likely to prepare himself. Now, a simple but perhaps instructive example of cross-examination conducted along these lines is quoted from Judge J.W. Donovan's Tact in Court. And it is mainly interesting in that it is reported to have occurred in Abraham Lincoln's first defense at a murder trial. Grayson was charged with shooting Lockwood at a camp meeting on the evening of August 9, 1845, and with running away from the scene of the killing, which was witnessed by Sovine. The proof was so strong that even with an excellent previous character, Grayson came very near being lynched on two occasions soon after his indictment for murder. Now, the mother of the accused, after failing to secure older counsel, finally engaged young Abraham Lincoln, as he was then called, and the trial came on to an early hearing. No objection was made to the jury, and no cross-examination of witnesses save the last and the only important witness, who swore that he knew the parties, swore that he saw the shot fired by Grayson, swore that he saw him run away and picked up the deceased, who died instantly in his arms. Now, the evidence of guilt and the identity of the perpetrator was morally certain. The attendance at the trial was large, the interest was intense, and Grayson's mother began to wonder why Abraham Lincoln remained silent for so long and why he didn't do something. Now, the people finally rested, and the tall lawyer, Abraham Lincoln, stood up and he eyed the strong witness in silence. Without any books, without any notes, and he slowly began his defense by asking these questions. Lincoln, and you were with Lockwood just before and you saw the shooting. Witness, yes. Lincoln, and you stood very near to them. Witness, no, about 20 feet away. Lincoln, may it not have been 10 feet? Witness, no, it was 20 feet or more. Lincoln, in the open field? Witness, no, in the timber. Lincoln, what kind of timber? Witness, beech timber. Lincoln, leaves on it are rather thick in August. Witness, rather. Lincoln, and you think this pistol was the one used? Witness, it looks like it. Lincoln, you could see the defendant shoot, see how the barrel hung and all about it? Witness, yes. Lincoln, how near was this to the meeting place? witness, three quarters of a mile away. Lincoln, where were the lights? Witness, up by the minister's stand. Lincoln, three quarters of a mile away? Witness, yes, I answered, ye twist. Lincoln, did you not see a candle there with Lockwood or Grayson? Witness, no. What would we want a candle for? Lincoln, how then did you see the shooting? Witness, defiantly, by moonlight. Lincoln, you saw this shooting at 10 o'clock at night in beech timber, three quarters of a mile from the light. You saw the pistol barrel. You saw the man fire the shot. You saw it 20 feet away, and you saw it all by moonlight. You saw it nearly a mile from the camp lights. Witness, yes, I told you so before. Now, the interest was now intense. It was so intense that men leaned forward to catch the smallest syllable. Then Lincoln drew out a blue-covered almanac from his side coat pocket. He opened it slowly, and he offered it into evidence. He showed it to the jury. He showed it to the court. And he read from a page, with careful deliberation, that the moon on that night was unseen and only arose at 1 o'clock the next morning. Now, following this climax, Lincoln moved the arrest of the perjured witness as the real murderer, saying nothing but a motive to clear himself could have induced him to swear away so falsely the life of one who never did him any harm. With such determined emphasis did Lincoln present his showing that the court ordered Sovine arrested, and under the strain and excitement, he broke down and confessed to being the one who fired the fatal shot himself, but he denied that it was intentional. Now, that's one of the techniques used in cross-examination. You take a statement that's made by a witness, it could be a police report, and you look at the statement and you say, that statement's an absolute lie. So you take the time to show that the statement made, in this case, the key statement was, I made my observations at 10 o'clock at night by moonlight. Lincoln knew that he was lying because he had interviewed his client. His client said he didn't kill the guy. He might not have known who did, but he could testify that there was no moonlight that night. So Lincoln took the time to say, well, gee, one guy in his report says there he saw this and it saw it by moonlight. This other guy says, well, I don't know who killed him, but there was no moonlight that night. Lincoln gets an almanac, and sure enough, there was no moonlight at 10 o'clock that night. The moon didn't come up until 1 o'clock. Now, he goes into the courtroom with the trap in his mind. He says to himself, I've got the almanac in my pocket. Can I get the witness to testify to these facts? So all of Lincoln's questions are aimed at getting this guy, Sovine, to admit, to make confessions. And he asks leading questions like, where were you standing? And Sovine said, well, I was standing in the timber. Well, could you have been in the open field? No, I wasn't in the open field. I was in the timber. Leaves are rather thick on that beech timber in August, aren't they? Yep, they are. Well, you know, if you're in the woods, it's darker in the woods than it would be out in an open field. So here's a guy that says, no, I was standing in the dark. Notice another question that Lincoln asked him. He said, how far away were you? And he said, 20 feet. Could it have been 10 feet? No, it couldn't have been 10. It was 20 feet or more. Notice Lincoln asked the question, where were the lights? Oh, they were 3/4 of a mile away. Now, here's this guy. He's digging his own pit. He says, no, I wasn't 10 feet away. I was 20 feet or more. No, I wasn't out in the open. I was in the woods. No, there weren't any lights there. The lights were 3/4 of a mile away. Now Lincoln asks the ringer, well then, how did you see all of this? Out here in the dark piney woods, or in this case, the dark beech woods. And the guy says, by moonlight. Well, when he answered by moonlight, now he's obviously lying. Now, whether he got this from a police report, whether he got this from the sheriff, whether he got this from direct examination, notice that Lincoln, when he walked into the courtroom, he's got the almanac in his pocket. He already knew the answer to the riddle. And he set the trap, and Sovine walked right into it. Now, that's the art of cross-examination. It isn't science. It isn't rocket science here that we're dealing with. We're talking about human nature. We're talking about vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. We're talking about a guy here who claims to be an eyewitness. Now remember, eyewitnesses are always listened to, aren't they? But eyewitnesses are oftentimes wrong. Now in this case, the eyewitness is lying intentionally. He's doing this on purpose. He's trying to get out of this himself. He's the actual killer. And Lincoln very carefully lays the trap and then springs it. Sovine was overconfident. Overconfident. Lincoln had what we call the trump card. The trump card. He took it to the high point. And then he dropped the bomb on the witness. The guy was an eyewitness, he claimed. But notice that he destroyed the testimony of an eyewitness, and he did it right in front of everybody. And the witness, out of his own mouth, condemned himself when he said, I saw it by moonlight, when that was obviously impossible. Now, getting a confession out of your opponent's own mouth is much more important than a he said, she said. You know, 3 witnesses that testify that there was no moonlight, and a witness who says, I saw it by the moonlight, is not nearly as good evidence as the evidence that Lincoln produced from the almanac. Scientific evidence, the moon rose at 1 o'clock. You heard the witness yourself say that he saw the killing at 10 o'clock in the beech timber, 20 feet away. Closest lights are 3/4 of a mile. And I saw it by moonlight. Let me give you our mid-program reminder. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. These Law Hour programs are scheduled, and our schedule and radio logs and our archives are also on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, history, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, let me give you another little story here. You know, a difficult but extremely effective method of exposing a certain kind of perjurer is to lead him gradually to a point in his story where in his answer to the final question, which, he will have to choose either one or the other of the only two explanations that are left to him, either of which would degrade, if not entirely discredit him in the eyes of the jury. Now, the writer once heard the Honorable Joseph H. Choate make very telling use of this method of examination. A stockbroker was being sued by a married woman for the return of certain bonds and securities in the broker's possession, which she alleged belonged to her. Now, her husband took the witness stand, and he swore that he had deposited the securities with the stockbroker as collateral against his own market speculations, but that they did not belong to him, and that he was acting for himself and not as an agent for his wife, and that he had taken her securities totally unknown to her. Now, it was the contention of Mr. Choate that even if the bonds did in fact belong to the wife, she had either consented to her husband's use of the bonds, or else was in fact a partner with him in the transaction. And both of these contentions were denied under oath by the husband. Mr. Choate asked this question. He said, "When you ventured into the realm of speculation in Wall Street, I presume that you contemplated the possibility of the market going against you, did you not?" And the witness responded, "Well, no, Mr. Choate, I went into Wall Street to make money, not to lose it." Mr. Choate, "Quite so, sir. But you will admit, will you not, that sometimes the stock market goes contrary to expectations?" Witness, "Oh, yes, I suppose it does." Mr. Choate, "You say that these bonds were not your own property, but your wife's." Witness, "Yes, sir." Mr. Choate, "And you say that she did not lend them to you for purposes of speculation or even know that you had possession of them." Witness, "Yes, sir." Mr. Choate, "You even admit then, do you not, that when you deposited these bonds with your broker as collateral against your stock speculations, you did not acquaint your broker with the fact that these bonds were not your own property?" Witness, "No, I did not mention whose property they were, sir. So Mr. Choate asked this closing question in his own inimitable style. He said, quote, "Well, sir, in the event of the market going against you and your collateral being sold to meet your losses, whom did you intend to cheat, your broker or your wife?" Who did you intend to cheat, your broker or your wife? It's what we call in sales the closing question. And once you have asked that closing question, the first guy to speak loses, we say in sales. In this case, it's called the high point in the examination. Now, it's pretty obvious that this guy is a thief. Well, he's either stealing his wife's bonds and using them for collateral, or his wife is in with him on the deal. In either event, it's either both of them are thieves or he's a thief, and what we're trying to do is to protect the broker here, aren't we? After all, the broker didn't know that these bonds belonged to somebody else. He took them in good faith. This guy said they're mine. So you lead the guy to a position in his testimony where we ask the question, were you beating your wife on Wednesday? Or are you still beating your wife on Wednesday? And no matter how he answers the question, you got him. And this isn't a forked question. We take his testimony and his answers, and we said, well, who did you intend to cheat, your broker or your wife? Now, that's a question that's very answerable. I intended to cheat my wife, I intended to cheat the broker, or I didn't intend to cheat anybody. Then we would ask, can you explain, then, why you took your wife's stock bonds and then didn't tell the broker whose they were? You got this guy dead to rights. And it's a technique that we use. It's a technique. Now let's take a look at another one here. You know, the witness could give no satisfactory answer, and for once the New York jury was found willing to give a verdict against the consumer and in favor of a Wall Street broker. But in the great majority of cases, the most skillful efforts of the cross-examiner will fail to lead the witness into such traps as this. If you have accomplished one such coup, be content with the point that you have made, and do not try to make another with the same witness. Sit down and let the witness leave the stand. Remind yourself of Josh Billings' advice. He said, when you strike oil, stop boring. Many a man has bored clean through and let the oil run out the bottom. When you hit pay dirt, stop and collect it. Stop and collect it. Don't let it run out the bottom. Now, you have succeeded in an expose. You have succeeded in exposing this manifest fraud. Now, remember, Abraham Lincoln exposed Sovine as being a liar. It's called the method called exposure. We are exposing this guy out of his own mouth. All right, let me see what we got here. Let's see if we can come up with another neat story here. Got Lincoln out of the way over here. Daniel Webster considered Mason the greatest lawyer that ever practiced at the New England bar. Remember, I told you that story. But I didn't give you an explanation of it. If the witness and the story sounds too pat, you say to yourself, well, gee, this story sounds like it's memorized. If somebody is telling the truth, you can elicit details out of the story. And the guy should be able to answer those details extemporaneously, because there's three methodologies that we use to determine whether somebody is telling the truth or whether they're lying. First of all, the story must be complete. You've got to tell a complete story from beginning to end. The story has to make sense from the point of view of the average Joe Sixpack on the street, the average truck driver, carpenter, plumber, electrician, you know, from his experience in life. Does this story make sense? Is it plausible? Is it possible? Sovine's story, yeah, I saw it by moonlight, is a very plausible story. Until you get to the almanac and the moon wasn't up at 10 o'clock on that date. So we expose the witness as a manifest liar. Well, that's our job as cross-examiners. Our sole goal as a cross-examiner is to show that the witness is lying, that his testimony isn't credible, that his story is incredible. That story doesn't make any sense. And then we pick that story apart, and we want the admissions out of the witness. We want the witness to tell us. Now, you may require you will require infinite patience in industry. You need to try to show that the story is inconsistent with itself, or with other known facts in the case, or with the ordinary experience of mankind. There's a wonderful power in persistence. If you fail in one quarter, you've got 22 more that you can employ. You can try something else. There's surely a weak spot somewhere if, in fact, the story is perjured. Now, if the story is true, you're never going to break the guy down. If this guy is telling the truth, that's the worst thing that can happen to you, is that this guy tells the truth about you. The best thing that can happen is that he lies. So you frame your questions skillfully. You ask them as if you wanted a certain answer, which in reality you desire just the opposite answer. Notice how Lincoln framed the question in such a way. He said, well, could you have been 10 feet away? The guy's already testified I was 20 feet. Could it have been 10? No. It was 20 feet or more. You frame the question in such a way that the witness believes that you want him to answer, yeah, I could have been 10 feet. Yeah, I could have been out in the open field. If he admitted that, then he would have been contradicting his former testimony. His previous testimony was he was in the beach timber. His previous testimony was he was 20 feet away. So, on direct examination, he'd already testified he was 20 feet away and he was in the beach timber. Lincoln came along and said, well, could you have been? And the guy immediately took the bait and he says, no, I already told you. I was 20 feet away. Now, you need to hold your own temper. It's very difficult to do, especially when you're defending yourself as a pro se litigant. When somebody lies about you and you know they're lying and you're looking at this guy on the witness stand and he looks you right in the eyeballs and lies right to your face, that's tough. But you have to hold your own temper while you lead this lying witness to lose his temper. That's the golden rule on all such occasions. If you allow that witness, that lying, perjured witness, a chance to give his reasons or explanations, you can be sure that they're going to be damaging to you and not to him. If you can succeed in tiring out the witness or in driving him to the point of sullenness, then you've produced the effect of lying. However, it's not intended to advocate the practice of lengthy cross-examinations, because the effect of a lengthy cross-examination that in effect goes nowhere unless the witness is broken down, unless you can succeed in your goal, then it has the exact opposite effect. It then leads the jury to exaggerate the importance of the evidence that the witness has given by a witness who requires so much cross-examination in the attempt to upset him. During the Tichborne trial for perjury, a remarkable man named Louis was called to testify. Now, Louis was a shrewd witness, and he told his tale with wonderful precision and apparent accuracy. That it was untrue, there could hardly be a question, but that it could be proved untrue was extremely doubtful and an almost hopeless task. It was an improbable story, but still it was a story that was not an absolute impossible story. And if the story was true, however, the claimant was the veritable Roger Tichborne, or at least the probabilities would be so immensely in favor of that supposition that no jury would agree in finding that he was Arthur Orton. So his manner of giving his evidence was perfect, and after the trial, one of the jurors was asked what he thought of Louis' evidence. What did you think of Louis' testimony, and if he ever attached any importance to his story? The juror replied that at the close of the evidence in chief, he thought it so improbable that no credence should be given to it. But after Mr. Hawkins had been at him for a day and a half and could not shake him on cross-examination, I began to think if such a cross-examiner as that cannot touch him, there must be something in what he's saying, and I began to waver. I could not understand how it was that if it was all lies, it did not break down under such able counsel. All right, so let's learn a lesson here. If a guy tells a story, and it's a lie, and you know it's a lie, but you can't prove it's a lie, shut up. Shut up. The burden is on you to show this guy's lying. And if you fail to show this guy's lying, then all of the effort that you put into the cross-examination verifies his story. No matter how improbable, no matter how ridiculous a story may have been. So you listen to the story, and if you have the evidence, if you can employ one of these 23 techniques, if you've got a document, if you've got a paper, if you've got some statement from deposition or out of his own mouth that you can cross him up using one of these 23 techniques, that's what you do. But if you don't, then you shut up. There's an old adage that says, if you don't have anything instructive or constructive to add to the case on cross-examination, then don't cross-examine. Pass. Not every witness that comes up against you is necessarily harmful to you. He comes in and tells his story. The red car hit the green car. It isn't necessary for you to get up there and make a great big scene to try to prove that the green car hit the red car. He testified that the red car hit the green car. Okay. Now, if that's a lie, and if you can prove that it's a lie, and you've got videotape, or you've got some evidence, and it's important, then show it. Impeach his testimony. Show that he didn't know what he was talking about. He may not be a liar. He may just be mistaken. He may actually believe what he's telling. But he's made a mistake. His testimony is false, and you're going to show that it's false. In some cases, I've actually seen cross-examinations where a witness came in and told some false statements that actually benefited the cross-examiner side of the case. It didn't hurt him. It actually benefited him. And he got in there and proved that this witness, who was testifying for the government, had lied, that he was mistaken, that he was dumb, that he was stupid, and proved the government's case from his cross-examination. The objective in cross-examination is to help your side, not the other side. So let's learn a lesson from this. If you can't prove the guy's lying, shut up. If the guy's story doesn't particularly harm your side, it isn't necessary to cross-examine him. If a witness offers damaging testimony against your side, and he's lying about your side, go after him and use one of these 23 techniques. If, on the other hand, he's lying about your side, but you can't prove that he's lying, you're better off to shut up and let the jury decide, well, how much credibility should I give to that witness? Because that's the jury's job, credibility. And this is why it's so important for a witness to take the stand in his own defense, if in fact he's innocent. jurors, when they're asked, why did you find this guy guilty? Well, 16 witnesses came in, said he was guilty. 16 witnesses pointed their finger at him and said, you're the one. And he never got on the witness stand and even so much as denied it. Pretty powerful evidence against you. Now, if six witnesses come in to testify against you, and one time I was in a case where six policemen came in to testify against me in a felony matter, charged me with destruction of jail property. And when I put those witnesses on the stand, each policeman in turn, every single policeman contradicted the other five. When the verdict came back from the judge, he said, you know, your testimony is so inconsistent, I can't believe it. Mr. Gordon's testimony is credible, and it appears to be true, accurate, and correct. I got on the witness stand and testified in my own defense. I said I did not destroy that jail property. I think that the jailers over here brought in that torn up jail suit, and I think that they planted it under my bed in the middle of the night with the express purpose of charging me with a crime because I wouldn't wear it. They lied. I didn't. Now that's very important. If you're telling the truth, you can stand up under cross-examination. If you're lying, you cannot stand up under cross-examination unless the cross-examiner is so inept and so unskillful that he doesn't know any of these techniques. And let me tell you that any lawyer worth his salt has read The Art of Cross-Examination by Francis Wellman, and so should you. So let me tell you that story again. This is a 1902 book. It's about 500 pages, a little under 500 pages. It is the standard in the legal business. Every lawyer in America has been trained out of Wellman when he went to law school. Wellman. The guy's name is Francis Wellman. The guy that wrote it was published back in 1902. That's why some of these stories in here relate to the Civil War, or they relate to 1887, or cases around the turn of the century. And that's because it's an old book. These are actual cases. These are actual techniques. These techniques have been around to boys and girls for hundreds of years. Lawyers have been imploring and using these kinds of techniques to uncover lying witnesses for hundreds of years. It's been a part and parcel with Anglo-Saxon administration forever. And you ought to know the same techniques that are being used against you. That levels out the playing field. And remember that we teach a class. We have a whole school here, a two-week school, on courtroom strategy and procedure, of which there are 28 things you need to know. One of those 28 things, number 25, is called cross-examination. And a good cross-examiner can't be beat. Remember the book, The Art of Cross-Examination, by Francis Wellman, published in 1902. Hey, we're just about out of time again. You know, time flies when you're having fun, so time's up. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world over the Internet 7 days a week. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, our schedule, and our archives. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, remember, go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. All right, we're just about out of time, so let me sign off right here. And thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. Until then, good night, friends.